this week at Hope Point.
The time will come when this Creator will personally squint and sweat beneath the sun's light and heat. God will enter this gainless world, endure its vanity, and feel the pain of Ecclesiastes. He will feel the pain of meaninglessness. He will feel the pain that you feel of the pointlessness of life. And Jesus will walk the streets of the now cursed Eden. And Jesus will stand beneath the sun with us and feel the pain of it all. He will feel the brokenness of it all. And from there, he will look at us and declare what Solomon could not declare in Ecclesiastes. And he will say to us, "Take heart, for I have overcome the world."
We're so glad to have you join us for today's message. We pray that it would challenge and encourage you to applaud God, follow Christ, and live on mission. Let's listen now as Dan speaks to us from God's holy word.
We're actually in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, so if you want to get there on your phones or in your Bibles and follow along with us this morning. Ecclesiastes is a complex, rather confusing little book, and so I got a lot of help from some very wise experts on the book, and one in particular is a guy named Zach Eswine. He wrote a commentary on Ecclesiastes called Recovering Eden, the Gospel According to Ecclesiastes. He's my primary resource for this morning's sermon, which is not typical of the way I prepare to preach. I consult a lot of commentaries when I preach, but Zach's approach to Ecclesiastes needs to be heard. And I have very little to add to his thoughts on the book. I pulled several thoughts from several chapters in the book to create the sermon this morning. A lot of it's even direct quotes from Zach, but I won't say Zach said, because that would probably get annoying for you all. But I did want to give him credit up front. It's an exceptional commentary, and if you want to know more about Ecclesiastes or if you like the direction of this sermon this morning, I encourage you to pick up his book. Like I said, he calls it, his commentary, Recovering Eden, which is the title I gave to my sermon this morning. And he's speaking, of course, of the Garden of Eden, that perfect paradise that we once had before our sin corrupted it. I love this view of Ecclesiastes because it points us to Eden by looking at what has become of it. And that's what we're going to do this morning. Ecclesiastes is just about the opposite of Eden. Just about the antithesis of Eden. Ecclesiastes should make us long for the recovery of Eden. And Lord knows the events of this past week alone should make us long for the return of Eden. We had the 24th anniversary of 9/11, the deadliest attack on American soil this week. There was a school shooting in a high school in Colorado. There was the murder of a young refugee girl just 75 miles north of us. And then there was the assassination of Charlie Kirk in front of thousands of people. So Ecclesiastes says, take a look at all of this. Take a look at all of the brokenness around you so that you will understand that it was not meant to be like this. So that you will understand that we were made for something more. We were meant for Eden, so hunger for its recovery. I believe we all long for Eden deep down inside, whether you recognize it or not. You long for the Garden of Eden. Everyone longs for the bullets to stop. Everyone longs for healing, for freedom. Everyone longs to break the chains of addiction. Everyone longs for peace, unending satisfaction, for purpose and for meaning. Everyone longs for sorrow to disappear and suffering to end. If you long for these things, well, then you long for Eden. Ecclesiastes forces us to take an honest look at ourselves and the world in which we live in order that we might long for something more. And that is the aim of my sermon this morning, that you would long for Eden. Long to be where you were made to be. This is the aim of Ecclesiastes. The book of Ecclesiastes is a sermon, really. Ecclesiastes means preacher. And according to verse 1 of Ecclesiastes 1, the preacher is none other than King Solomon. However, this is no ordinary preacher. In fact, when you read the book of Ecclesiastes, you're going to be shocked at a preacher speaking this way. It hits a little bit different knowing that a preacher talks like this. You expect maybe an Old Testament prophet to speak this way, but not a leader of people. We do not expect the words that we find here. And Zach says, these inspired words which disturb us reveal aspects of God too often neglected by us. I love this about Ecclesiastes. It's raw emotion that points us beyond the cursed earth to Eden. One of the ways God leads us to know him is by having us look in the mirror to see what we have become. Ecclesiastes says, look at what you have become. Look at all that has become of my Eden. In Ecclesiastes, God intends us to know him by requiring us to look plainly and without polish at ourselves, our neighbors, and in the world in which we live. Ecclesiastes confronts us with our own ills in order that we might come to know God as he is. He says, look around. Look at what has become of Eden and know that you've been made for something more. The preacher here is not only a speaker, you know, high and lofty, speaking from his pulpit, not understanding what we're going through. He is right in the middle of the mess. He is a companion in life. He doesn't try to paint a beautiful picture of what life is. He's real and he's raw. So you might be surprised when the preacher tells us that he hated life, Ecclesiastes 2:17. And that gaining wisdom and knowledge does nothing but stress us out and make us sad because we know we can't fix this mess, Ecclesiastes 1:18. Most of us have not encountered this type of preaching before. By Ecclesiastes, we see that God is not afraid to tell it like it is. He doesn't shy away from mystery, emotions, or messes of people or life. Ecclesiastes shows us more about God than perhaps we are comfortable with. So Ecclesiastes is wisdom literature. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. These are wisdom books, wisdom genre of literature. But the best way, I think, to view Ecclesiastes is in relation to Proverbs. So Ecclesiastes shows us, Proverbs shows us the norms and the rules of how life should be. And Ecclesiastes shows us the exceptions. Let me give you an example. So in Proverbs, it says, disaster pursues sinners, but the righteous are rewarded with good. So you read a verse like this and you say, and if your life is a disaster, you're like, well, great, I guess I'm a sinner. Or if your life is not filled with reward, then Proverbs says you must not be righteous. This is the logic. If you remember Job's friends in the book of Job, this is sort of the logic that they knew of, the Proverbs logic. And they pointed at Job and said, you must have done something wrong, Job. You must not be righteous, Job, or God would not be doing this to you. Well, we come to Ecclesiastes and we read a verse like this. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. You see, Job's friends knew the proverbial rule, but had no category for the exception that righteous men suffer to. Ecclesiastes is the wisdom literature that gives us the exception. Not every exception to every proverb, of course, but it tells us that life is not so tidy as Proverbs might make it out to be. So we need Ecclesiastes to balance out the predictability of Proverbs. God is the God of Proverbs, and God is the God of the messy Ecclesiastes. So in the English language, seems difficult to learn, and there's many exceptions, and we hate exceptions, right? We hate learning the exceptions. It's frustrating. But in spelling, the rule is what? I before E, and what's the exception? Except after C, and sometimes Y, and in words that sound like A, such as neighbor and way. When we finally master the rule, the teacher says, well, it doesn't always work that way. Proverbs is the I before E, in Ecclesiastes is the except after C and sometimes Y. A student who cannot accept the exceptions and remains hasty to avoid anything but the rule will struggle to spell. And so it is with life. You'll struggle in life if you don't understand that God meant us to live in exceptions. We need Ecclesiastes then to keep us from entrusting ourselves to trite formulas under the sun. Ecclesiastes reminds us that we cannot go out into our neighborhoods and hand out a one-size-fits-all t-shirt. Life does not work that way. Life under the sun is not that tidy. The preacher describes life as how it actually presents itself under the sun, the way most of us live. The preacher does not stick to the rules of what should be, but addresses the exceptions to account for what really is. This is Ecclesiastes. If Proverbs is like an accountant, dealing with rules and regulations and debits and credits that always equal each other, then Ecclesiastes is like the artist who paints with emotion and mood and feeling. If Proverbs is like meteorology, giving us indicators to predict the weather, then Ecclesiastes is like the actual weather, fickle and unpredictable day in and day out. In Proverbs, a good man plus God's wisdom and love equals a good life. But in Ecclesiastes, a good man plus God's love dies like the fool or the beast. So I believe most of us live in the land of exceptions. I believe most of us here live in the city of Ecclesiastes. So Ecclesiastes comes to us as an unexpected voice, but a needed voice so that we can navigate this messy life under the sun. So with this in mind today, I want to unpack chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes. And in verse 2 of chapter 1, we get the preacher's main point. We get his sort of thesis, and then the rest of the book, he's supporting his main point, which is verse 2. So let's read verse 2, his main point. The preacher says, vanity of vanity. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Vanity in the Hebrew means a mist, a wisp of vapor, a mere breath, a puff of wind. Metaphorically, it means empty, meaningless, pointless. And so we have this preacher getting up into the pulpit and shouting, life is pointless. Not a great way to start out a sermon. We're not making sermon jams out of this introduction for sure. Life is pointless, the preacher says, and he says it three times. All earthly experience is subject to vanity. It's empty, it's pointless, it's void of meaning. And the preacher begins his explanation about why everything is meaningless by asking this question in verse 3. He says, what does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? He says life is pointless. And so where is the gain in all of this? All of this running around and stressing out and anxiety-filled hearts for what? If it's all pointless, where's the gain? Where's the true meaning in life? Remember, the preacher wants us to take a hard look at what Eden has become. And he uses this phrase, under the sun, quite often in Ecclesiastes. And so when you hear the phrase, under the sun, think of seeking satisfaction or seeking your happiness in the things of earth and the people of earth. It's all under the sun. So with this question, the preacher is asking us to consider what is true gain? If all of life is meaningless, where do we find the gain? Zach, in his commentary, references George Bailey from the Christmas movie, It's a Wonderful Life. And George wanted to gain more from his life. And it's captured in this quote here. He says, I couldn't face being cooped up for the rest of my life in a shabby little office. I want to do something big, something important. You see, two assumptions lived in George's head here with this quote, and they probably live in all of our heads as well. See, George assumed, number one, that if importance is to be gained in this life, he must travel to another patch of earth somewhere other than he currently resides. Right? The grass is greener over there. In our sin-infected minds, we always believe that gain, call it happiness or satisfaction, is somewhere other than where we presently reside. And this was George's first assumption when he says a quote like this. The second assumption, which is related to that, is that he believed once he got to that other patch of earth, once he got to the greener grass on the other side, that that would bring him happiness, that he would no longer be discontent, that he would feel honored and accomplished. This was the two assumptions living in his head and probably in ours too, that happiness is somewhere else, somewhere other than I am, and when I get there, I will truly be happy. The preacher's here to tell us that the problem is not localized to our current place or circumstances. When you get out of your current situation or your current circumstances and you travel to another patch of earth, the same feelings of discontent will again show up because the problem is universal. That's what the preacher is telling us. It's not simply your current situation. The problem resides under the sun. We believe that a different place or a different life situation is what's going to bring us happiness. That a different life situation or a different job is going to bring us satisfaction. The preacher here says, nope, all of life is meaningless, and therefore it will eventually bring about discontent. Another patch of earth is just earth. Job A and job B are not that different because they both reside under the sun. Now, this doesn't mean that we never leave a unhealthy situation, but what the preacher is getting at here is looking for true satisfaction in the people, in the places, in the life situations, in the jobs that we have. It's not found there because it resides under the sun. So if these two assumptions were balloons in George's brain, Ecclesiastes is the needle meant to pop them. And so the preacher again asks this question, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And as you probably know, this gain here is not like material possessions or a profit. The gain the preacher is after is what is truly meaningful in life. Where is the true gain? Jesus asked the same question, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world? And the preacher's answering that question for us, it's not, because it's all meaningless. Even if you gain the whole world, it's pointless, the preacher says. So he intends us to assess gain more broadly than our material holdings. Not only are we materially famished, but we're soul-starved people looking for emotional and relational leftovers, looking for a point to it all, looking for meaning in life. And because we're prone to take this soul search to the earth and to the people around us, Ecclesiastes painfully destructs these dreams. Looking under the sun for true gain by your toil is like trying to buy medicine in a shoe store. I love this illustration that Zach gives us. Trying to find true gain is like trying to buy medicine in a shoe store. Shoes are great. They provide exactly what you need, shoe stores do, when you're looking for shoes. The problem is that when you need medicine, the shoe store is a terrible place to look for it. The shoe store was not meant to provide medicine. Of all the things you love about shoes and shoe stores and shopping, it was not meant to provide medicine. And for all of its beauty and all of its dignity, the earth simply does not possess the ability to provide you what you so desperately need. The preacher uses the rest of chapter 1 to prove his point. He wants to prove that what we're searching for cannot be found under the sun. That need that's screaming in your heart cannot be found in what is under the sun. That's what the preacher is telling us here. Ultimately, the preacher wants us to understand and see what is vain and what is meaningless and what is pointless in this life in order that we might discover what is not. So in order to prove this, prove the meaninglessness of everything that is under the sun, the preacher tells us several things. I'll point out four, and I'll show them to you right now. And this is going to be a little bit depressing, to be honest. And just hold on, there's hope at the end, all right? He says, remember, his thesis is Everything is meaningless. Life is pointless. And he says everything is forgotten. And because everything is tired and everything is old, and you know what? We can't fix it. So let's start out with everything is forgotten. Ecclesiastes 1:4 says, a generation goes and a generation comes. We keep churning through generations over and over and over again. And then in verse 11, he says, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to come, yet to be among those who come after. We're churning through generations and we can't even remember the people that have gone before us. So if you stop and think about it, we have never heard of almost everyone who has ever lived. I'll say that again. We have never heard of almost everyone who has ever lived. And most of those we've heard of, we don't personally know. And even those that go down in history, we know incompletely. So this is what the preacher is saying. Whatever you clutch to, whatever you're grabbing, whatever you're collecting, whatever you're striving for will soon fade from memory. Where is the gain in all that, the preacher says? Even your family, how much do you know about your grandfather? Or how much less do you know about your great-grandfather? Or even less, how much do you know about your great-great-grandfather? In just a few generations, you will be forgotten to even by your family. And that's sad. How much more than the things that we strive after, the things that we're after day in and day out, and the things that we worry about day in and day out, how much more are those things going to fade from memory? He finishes verse 4 with this phrase, but the earth remains forever. So we're going through these generations, but the earth is still here. The earth remains. See, we view the same sun today, the same sun that you see when you go out there today, is the same sun that Adam and Eve saw thousands and thousands of years ago. The point is, when we die, the sun's going to rise, and another generation is going to come after us, and they're going to die, and the sun's going to rise again. For this reason, looking for gain in what exists outside of our windows during the day is like trying to make a snowman indoor in August in South Carolina. It's not going to happen. Winter fades, the yard thaws, spring and summer have their way. So toiling among fading people and times and things in order to try to make our lives count is fruitless. Everything gets forgotten. Not only is everything forgotten, but everything is tired. The preacher sort of pulls back the curtain of creation to show how tired things are. And he says that even the vibrant nature is bored and discontent with the monotony of nonstop performance. Look at verse 7 and 8. He says, all streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. So these streams are just keep flowing and flowing, and they're going to the lakes and the oceans and the seas, and the lakes and the ocean and the seas are not being filled up. The Apostle Paul describes this exhaustion of creation in terms of bondage, that the creation was subjected to futility, in bondage to corruption. And Paul says that even the creation is longing to be set free from this bondage to corruption. And he poetically says that the creation is like a woman groaning in childbirth. So this once Eden has become a place of groaning, even for the creation. So we are not alone in this. Creation can provide something good for sure, but it cannot satisfy our true need. Even creation is tired. The preacher continues in verse 8, and says, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. Like, we cannot even satisfy our eyes, even with the beauty of creation and the Grand Canyon and waterfalls and oceans and nature and people. We are not satisfied. The eye is never satisfied, and all the things that we hear, our ears are never satisfied from hearing more. We're going to go out from here and check Facebook and X and whatever it is you look at and we're continually filling our ears with stuff and it's not satisfying. Sunshine is pleasant and a glorious sight, but it cannot satisfy us. It's like our kids. They get their Christmas gifts and 3 days later they're bored with them. And we too are tired of good things. Restlessness always sets in and we want something more. We get tired of even beautiful things. So not only does the preacher teach us that everything is forgotten and that everything is tired, he says everything is old. Look at verse 9 and 10. He says, what has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? Mm-mm. It has been already in the ages before us. So the thing the preacher is getting at here is not like new things or new inventions, right? We invent new things all the time. An iPhone comes out every year. I think they just announced 17 this past week. So this is not what he's talking about. We get new things all the time. His focus here is the toil of human beings under the sun for new things to solve old problems. There's nothing new. Even new things do not solve our deepest and core problem. There's nothing under the sun that's going to help. Nothing new. Every human being has tried to navigate food and clothing and shelter, but we have failed to figure life out. We wrestle every day, day in and day out, with life and providing a good way for our families. Putting a space station in the sky has not kept our families intact, delivered us from dictators, or eradicated a selfish heart. New things cannot solve these problems. AI and the internet have done nothing to eradicate hate, wars, and school shootings. There's nothing new under the sun that will solve these problems. It's all old. So finally, the preacher says, maybe the worst of it all, we can't fix it. Look at verse 15. He says, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. That's a hard one to hear. Like, there's so much lack, so much missing in this world that we can't even count it. And what is broken, we can see it all around us, and we can't make it right. Can't make what's crooked straight. With all of our wisdom and all of our striving, we just can't do it, the preacher says. And having wisdom doesn't even help. Look what he says in 17 and 18. He says, I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. For much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Like getting wiser doesn't even help, the preacher says. Like, that only increases our sorrow because we're wise enough to see more brokenness, and we're also wise enough to know that we can't fix it. And so it brings on more sorrow, being smarter. So getting smarter is not going to fix the problem. No matter how smart or how powerful one is, trying to solve the unhappy business of life is like trying to catch the wind, the preacher says. It's like going out into your front yard and trying to capture that wind in your hands. It's insanity, and your neighbors will think you're insane. For all of these reasons, the preacher yells, it's all vanity. It's all meaningless. Life is pointless. Trying to find true meaning or purpose in a job, a spouse, a relationship, drugs, alcohol, sex, money, a bigger house, or a new city is pointless because everything under the sun is pointless apart from him who created it. So just in chapter 1, the preacher has already dismantled the earthly persons and things that we are prone to clutch and stomp in order to make our lives count. He pops the balloons of our bad assumptions that tell us that true satisfaction is simply in another set of circumstances. No, the real problem is not in your circumstances or your stage of life, but in the cursed earth, the upside down Eden. So you get to this point in the preacher's sermon and you're like, wow, surely now this guy is going to talk about God. And the preacher will tell us about God. But remember, this is Ecclesiastes, and it's not going to be in the way that we expect. This is no like quick healing preacher. The raw searcher wants honest answers with no spins about how things really are. This is a slow evangelistic process. One weekend, 30-minute sermon is not going to do for this preacher. True questioners will not trifle with quick slogans or 160-character tweets or a Bible verse on a coffee cup or a t-shirt or a tattoo. This is a slow process. So the preacher tells us about God, but not as our Redeemer, not yet. At this moment, we are meant to consider God as he who governs and has authority over that which is under the sun. God is the one, we need to understand this, God is the one who lets the gainless, pointless world go on as it is. God is the one who does not stop us from having to deal with vanity. And so we must deal with this fact. We must face this fact. And he says it in Ecclesiastes 1:13. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Preacher says this is a sad business to deal with this pointless life. It's an unhappy business that God has given us. So in chapter 1, the sermon's introduction, I want you to think of it this way. It's sort of as if he's taken a snapshot or a picture. I'm sure you watch like a Netflix series, right? And you get maybe a season or two in, and then they have this one episode where it's like a flashback. And it's it helps you understand the backstory of the characters you currently know in the series. I think that's what's happening here in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. It's like a picture of that frowning moment in the Garden of Eden. As Adam and Eve don their fig leaves to cover their shame and the serpent is caught in his treason, God declares a curse upon all that he has made. And that's what we're seeing in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. A look at the Garden of Eden right after the fall. Adam and Eve will live by God's grace, but from that point on, thorns and thistles, pain and sweat and murders and assassinations and hurricanes and tsunamis and earthquakes and poverty and drug addiction and broken families and old age and disease await us all outside of that garden east of Eden. And this is what we're left with. So the preacher exalts that aspect of God's character that did not relieve Adam and Eve or the serpent from sin's consequences. This is our God. This is the God who governs. He did not stop the unhappy business of paradise lost. So we must linger here. So God will not bring salvation by giving us escape and immunity from the now cursed Eden. In fact, Jesus himself, before he was crucified, prayed that God would not take us out of this cursed world. He said, I do not ask you to take them out of the world, but you keep them from the evil one. Jesus intends us to endure the meaninglessness. And like the preacher in Ecclesiastes, Jesus too will highlight suffering in this world in the now cursed Eden. John 16:33, Jesus says, in the world you will have tribulation. We don't get to escape the meaninglessness, Jesus says. So if there's no escape from what is under the sun, then rescue will have to come from somewhere else. We need to be rescued. We need to be rescued from the vanity of it all. We need to be rescued from the pointlessness of it all. We need to be rescued from the meaninglessness of it all. And Ecclesiastes points us to the Creator for help. And we know that Creator is also our Redeemer. The time will come when this Creator will personally squint and sweat beneath the sun's light and heat. God will enter this gainless world, endure its vanity, and feel the pain of Ecclesiastes. He will feel the pain of meaninglessness. He will feel the pain that you feel of the pointlessness of life. And Jesus will walk the streets of the now cursed Eden. And Jesus will stand beneath the sun with us and feel the pain of it all. He will feel the brokenness of it all. And from there, he will look at us and declare what Solomon could not declare in Ecclesiastes. And he will say to us, "Take heart, for I have overcome the world." You see, Jesus has conquered the meaninglessness. When he stepped into this world, he began the recovery of Eden. When Jesus died on the cross, he began the reversal of all that went wrong in Eden. And so, like Adam and Eve, we can again have a relationship with God because of Jesus Christ. Because of Jesus, God is with us in this now cursed Eden. Because of Jesus Christ, we can have a relationship with God. So whether we're on this patch of earth or another patch of earth, or whether you're in this job or in this life situation or that life situation, God is with you. God is with us in the now cursed Eden. Is he enough? He wasn't for Adam and Eve. Is a relationship with the Creator enough for you to stop striving after the wind? Stop searching for medicine in the shoe store. Stop searching for true gain under the sun. The preacher knows it's not found there. Jesus knows it's not found there. And I think deep down inside, you know it's not found there. Maybe you're here today and you're fed up with your pointless life. Maybe you're like the preacher, you can't see anything but meaninglessness. But by God's grace today, you've seen a glimmer of hope. Maybe for the first time, you can see beyond what is under the sun, and perhaps you want it. Perhaps you want him. Repent and believe in Jesus Christ today and be saved, and you too will be part of the recovery of Eden.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast from Hope Point Church in Spartanburg, South Carolina. If you would like to learn more about us or give to this ministry, please go to our website at hopepoint.org. We hope you can join us again next week.